Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and as Jim pointed out in the morning jolt today, Monday night debates make you sad that Monday night football's gone already and the playoffs aren't even over yet. But we got the umpteenth debate among the remaining presidential hopefuls on the Republican side. Five are left on stage, and there were a number of excitable moments, mainly because I don't know what the crowd had before the debate, Jim, but they were fired up just about every different turn here. One of the great confrontational moments came when Juan Williams, who was one of the panelists, tried to confront Newt Gingrich about statements he had made earlier about poor kids would be wise to get jobs as janitors at their schools or other relatively low-skilled jobs just to understand what it's like to have a job, make some money, and help to ward off the poverty their family might be dealing with. Juan Williams tried to confront him on that, saying that it sounded as though Gingrich was criticizing the work ethic of poor people and especially minorities. Here's how Newt Gingrich devastated Juan Williams from there as Williams finished up his follow-up question.
Where a woman asked you why you refer to President Obama as the food stamp president, it sounds as if you are seeking to belittle people.
First of all, Juan, the fact is that more people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history. I know among the politically correct, you're not supposed to use facts that are uncomfortable. I believe every American of every background has been endowed by their creator with the right to pursue happiness. And if that makes liberals unhappy, I'm going to continue to find ways to help poor people learn how to get a job, learn how to get a better job, and learn someday to own the job.
Jim, it's almost like when you hear something like that, you go back a few weeks before the whole Bain Capital thing blew up and you almost want to forget it and say, that's the Newt Gingrich we thought we were going to get throughout the rest of this campaign. We couldn't leave in the thunderous applause that forced Bret Baier to try and work his way to a break. Gingrich nailed it, and Juan Williams was definitely the one on the short end of the stick there.
Yeah, just for our listeners, we wanted to include the applause, but we try to keep this podcast about 10 to 15 minutes. We'd run over them. Look, this is the distilled essence of why people like Newt and why he can be so infuriating. You know, readers of the Campaign Spot know that I have said made a criticism or two of the former speaker. But this was him at his best. It's kind of surprising. I mean, Juan Williams, certainly a left of center guy, former NPR commentator, Fox News commentator, but you know, always seemed like a fairly reasonable one. That question really kind of seemed to say, well, some people were offended by it, so don't you feel bad about offending people? You know, aren't you trying to belittle the president? You know, almost to send, you know, Newt on a guilt trip. And Newt doesn't play those games, okay? You know, Newt just swatted it down. The disdain in the Juan, I don't know if audio really accurately conveys the tone of that, but Williams kind of had it coming in the sense that he really seemed to suggest that, you know, that there was racial animosity at the heart of Gingrich's assessment. And while I think you can certainly say that his original comments on poor kids working in schools may have come out a little clumsily, may not have been the most melodious of tones. You know, the idea that racial animosity was at the heart of it is pretty outrageous, and it looks like another egregious example of playing the race card. If you don't like that, stay tuned for the third martini. but this was perhaps Newt at his best, and, you know, Luntz had said in the post-game show, this got a standing ovation. Now, admittedly, this is a crowd that looked like they were doing whiskey shots during the commercial break. So, I mean, after a while, they started applauding every time Newt used the word fundamentally. Fundamentally, woo! So, on the one hand, we shouldn't judge too much by the crowd reaction. On the other hand, I think Juan Williams kind of, you know, had that very clear subtext of, look, you're a Republican, you're talking about urban youth. Wasn't there something racist about what you said? And, you know, Newt just slam dunked him on that. And I think, you know, a lot of Republicans are sick and tired of having every one of their motives questioned and the rather casual accusations of racism. And so this is Newt at his best. And considering how Romney stumbled a bit in this debate, and I think South Carolina is going to turn into kind of the primary of the not mitts, I think that Newt made a very strong pitch last night, much more stronger than I think a lot of people expected after the stumbles in recent weeks focusing on Bain.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Bain was also a topic early on in the debate with both Gingrich and Perry going after Mitt Romney on that issue. Romney, in some cases, doing better than others in defending himself. But one of his weakest moments was actually in the post-debate show with Sean Hannity on the Fox News Channel, where Hannity tried to get Mitt to admit that there have been some pretty tough, very negative ads from his very close personal friends in his super PAC, and Mitt trying to make the contention here that, well, they didn't come directly from his campaign, so I've been positive the whole time.
If you watch the debate tonight, I don't think you heard me criticize anybody on the stage.
I'm talking more about the feeling.
And likewise, the ads that we have all been positive. I'm going to take exception with the premise.
It's the premise being the super. I can tell you from speaking with the other candidates, there's palpable anger about the super PAC ads, and they had wanted you to denounce them and say that
anything that's inaccurate. And I said this in the last debate. They should take them off the air.
Romney went on to say he'd only actually been aware of one of the ads that his super PAC put out there, which, Jim, beggars the imagination a little bit.
It does. Now, there are two exchanges on the topic of super PACs. It's kind of fascinating how this has become kind of a central argument of this debate at this and of this contest between these candidates at this point. At first, Romney had this really awful, well, gee whiz, I have no idea what's going on in these super PAC ads. I have no connection to these people. I have no control over it. In the second one, Gingrich kind of said, will you tell him to stop it? And, you know, Romney pointed out, well, wait a second. Is it a felony for a candidate to interact with the super PAC? You know, aren't these supposed to be independent? Isn't coordination a violation of federal law? And Gingrich said, yes. So in a way, Gingrich kind of admitted that he was asking Mitt Romney to commit a felony. Look, Mitt's doing everything he can within the law to get himself elected. And I don't think there's anything, you know, particularly nefarious about that. I just think it's kind of he kind of insults our intelligence when he acts like these rogue former staffers making these negative ads. Like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that these people would form a super PAC to write negative ads. No. As I wrote in the Morning Jolt, creating a super PAC that's allegedly independent is basically creating your own bad cop. We've seen throughout the years Barack Obama is very good at staying above the fray and letting his surrogates attack his opponents in the most, you know, ruthless and furious ways. Well, Romney has his super PAC. Romney is the Detective Sipowicz of the Romney campaign, working over all the opposing guys, knocking them around and you know, making, some would argue, you know, dubious or inaccurate charges, or at the very least, you know, brutal. You know, it is a way for get Romney to run an extraordinarily negative campaign without officially running an extraordinarily negative campaign. And I think that I have less of an objection of the tactic than the, you know, cutesy, innocent, who me look that Romney, you know, always seems to give whenever the topic comes up. In the second discussion of the debate, he did mention how he wishes that there were just no limits and everybody could just, you know, give unlimited donations to campaigns and send it to these super PACs so they aren't this kind of backdoor way of running attack ads, et cetera. But I think it was a rough night for Romney, and I think this is one of those moments where you just were left eye-rolling and saying, oh, come on, Governor. We know what you have to legally say, but, you know, don't. It's like, who are we going to believe? You know, you or our lying eyes.
For a guy who folks still have an issue with, if you watch that Twitter question that Brett Baer asked him about, how can we trust that you won't flip-flop, I think people just want veracity and honesty and straightforwardness from Mitt Romney, and that didn't help him on that question, although he may have helped himself in some other ways. But for any criticism we may have of Mitt Romney in Martini number two, we're going to leap to his defense here in Martini number three, because this is just beyond the pale. If you thought Juan Williams' question was crazy, wait till you see what happened on the Al Sharpton show, or whatever they call it there on MSNBC. Here's the horrific quote that he was reacting to along with South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn. This is Mitt Romney after he won the New Hampshire primary. This is just horrible.
President Obama wants to put free enterprise on trial.
Yeah.
And in the last few days, we've seen some desperate Republicans join forces with him. This is such a mistake for our party and for our nation. The country already has a leader who divides us with the bitter politics of envy.
And so when you hear criticism of President Obama dividing on income inequality, one name should immediately come to mind. And of course, Jim Clyburn brought it up.
That's a little bit like saying to Rosa Parks that you are just jealous, envious of that man who's got a seat on this bus because you want a seat on the bus.
Jim, I think every conservative in America is saying, just stop. I mean, Jim Clyburn has kind of become a caricature of himself because he injects racism into absolutely everything. And I don't think anybody in a rational political discourse takes him seriously anymore. But this is what's going to happen when a sitting president doesn't have much to run on. And that's who he needs to turn out in big numbers to support him. Get ready, conservatives, because it's inevitable. It's coming down the pike.
Yeah, I look at this, and you know, it feels like we've done this as our crazy martini or bad martini many, many times, Greg, or at least comments in this vein. And I'm kind of left wondering, I don't want to say why it works, because I don't know if this argument necessarily, we'll have to see if there's any, you know, shift in Romney's numbers or anything, but I don't think a congressman saying that Mitt Romney is anti-Rosa Parks or whatever the hell the point was with that inane comment was designed to do there. What's interesting, though, is that you see, and it often comes from African-American Democratic officeholders, this willingness to basically, you know, assert horrific racial animosity on the part of white Republicans and, you know, never cite any serious evidence of it, to basically make, you know, that Romney's economic argument is basically, you know, rooted in racism. And everyone just kind of, you know, like his audience certainly didn't object. Certainly Reverend Al wasn't going to, you know, raise any objection to it.
No.
And just life goes on. And I'm kind of left by the fact we're now beyond outrage. I mean, you and I are talking about this, but, you know, you and I will go on with our lives. There really is no way to play the race card in a way that totally immolates the speaker's credibility anymore. Right? I mean, can you think of any good recent examples of this sort of thing?
Where it actually blew up in their face? Not really, yeah. Because nobody ever holds them to it.
There are times where it doesn't necessarily work. There was this great The Daily Show routine in which the correspondent joked that the race card has now been overdrawn. But I don't think that we really see it's now kind of like to adopt the John Edwards phrase, we're in two Americas. On the Democratic side, you can say these things and everyone will just kind of nod in assent and believe that it's, you know, ipso facto that all Republicans are racists. And everyone else just kind of like, I'm not even sure if Republicans get that upset about it anymore. And maybe we should. This is the sort of thing that can always get the Irish up and Jay Nordlinger. But we just kind of almost grown to accept it. And I don't think we should. But on the other hand, I don't know if there's any really more effective way. Clearly, nothing we say has any impact on these African-American lawmakers who are very willing to play the race card when they need to attack an opponent. And I don't think that we've ended up in this bizarre rhetorical stalemate in which nobody really impacts the other. And I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. It's kind of a depressing thought on the Martin Luther King Day. But this is where we are in 2011. I can think of few crazier martinis than to have this one. It, like the statement itself is crazy, and the fact that everyone will collectively shrug their shoulders at it is crazier even so. Still.
Yeah, the double standard in this is just astonishing. Just the day earlier, Valerie Jarrett is railing against the GOP from a pulpit in Atlanta church. I think it was Martin Luther King's church in Atlanta, Georgia. And, of course, she pays no political price. The Democrats and the church pay no political price. If that had been a conservative Republican from a pulpit, you can bet that the IRS would be there with their full crew with boxes of files just rifling through that place. But, of course, it doesn't happen when it's the other way around. Ooh. Jim, welcome back. Have a great day.
Always good to be here, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Wednesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.